Our final case for today is case number 68427, Sheldon Tosh versus State of Nevada. Mr. Garman for the appellant, Mr. Mills for the respondent.
Justice Sherk, I'd like to comment on this, and thank you both for being here. I can tell you this panel was really concerned about this issue. It's one reason we have oral argument, this enhancement procedure, how it's supposed to be done under Nevada law, and what we should do and not do. So we're really going to be interested in what you both have to say about the case law, the Spear case, State versus Smith, any other authority, whether a DA can testify from out of state to, is that good enough to do enhancement? So those are some of the, just to give you some background why we wanted to really get into it. We appreciate you both coming out from Elko to get into this issue for us. Thank
you. May it please the court. I'm Benjamin Gobbin, Elko County Deputy Public Defender. I'm representing the interests of Sheldon Tosh, and I make my very first appearance on this tribunal.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And best wishes.
I appreciate that, too.
To both of you.
Now, Mr. Tosh was convicted on March 18th of 2015 of driving under the influence of intoxicating liquor. Now, what happened during the course of that trial is not the subject of this appeal. However, what happened afterward is, in particular, the state sought to enhance this DUI to a third offense. And there's a 2008 conviction from Faulkner County, Arkansas, as well as a 2006 conviction from Sherwood, Arkansas. We didn't challenge the Sherwood conviction. We did challenge the Faulkner County, Arkansas conviction. Now, what's beyond dispute with regards to Faulkner County was that Mr. Tosh pled to a first offense DUI. What's unclear in the record is whether or not the DUI second that had been originally charged as was dropped down to a DUI first pursuant to negotiations. We don't know, and the state of Nevada admits they don't know either. Now, what we do know from the minutes of Faulkner County, Arkansas, is that the reason that the DUI second was dropped was, quote, due to lack of evidence after request made to Sherwood. So what happens in district court, when considering whether to strike the 2008 conviction for enhancement purposes, was to consider whether or not this was pursuant to plea negotiations, and Judge Porter said no, it wasn't due to plea negotiations, but due to a lack of evidence. And the defense disagrees with her reasoning because plea negotiations are entered into all the time based on a lack of evidence. For instance, a murder case can be dropped to a manslaughter case if there's a lack of evidence in mens rea. And even under Nevada law, when it pertains to DUIs, NRS 484C.420 allows prosecutors in very limited instances to drop a second offense to a first offense due to a lack of evidence. So if we were to follow Judge Porter's line of reasoning, we would have to assume that the prosecutor in Faulkner County dropped the DUI second to a DUI first before coming to the negotiating table, and in essence sacrificing leverage before even starting. And we don't think that's the most reasonable interpretation to gather from the proceedings in Faulkner County. Now, there was mention earlier about a prosecutor from Arkansas. That prosecutor's name is Chris Carnahan. He was not a party to the plea negotiation. We would submit that what he testified to at that motion to strike the prior conviction proceeding, he had...
Did he testify in person or by video?
Neither. He testified by phone, from what I recollect.
Okay.
And Mr. Carnahan had testified to what he had seen in the minutes, but he was not privy to the exact agreement whatsoever. And he was not even part of that office, the prosecuting office, that prosecuted Mr. Tosh for that particular conviction. But he did discuss Arkansas law. What would happen if an individual gets charged with a DUI after having three prior DUIs that were treated as first offenses? That's completely irrelevant to this case because Mr. Tosh didn't pick up a fourth offense in Arkansas. He picked up a DUI in Elko County, was convicted of a DUI in Elko County, Nevada, not in Arkansas. So his analysis there doesn't pertain to the issue on this appeal. Now, the district court cited Davenport v. versus state. There was this issue of burden of proof and who to put the burden of proof on with respect to showing whether or not this conviction from Faulkner County, Arkansas, should be used to enhance Mr. Tosh's conviction to a third offense. Now, Davenport applies to cases where there's a challenge to the spirit of constitutional principles in that proceeding. In this case, Faulkner County, Arkansas. I want to state unequivocally, we are not challenging whether or not that was constitutionally adequate, that conviction in Faulkner County. What we are arguing here is that the spirit of constitutional principles was not respected in the district court, in the district court of Elko County. And we know that because we look at State versus Smith, which is the case that is most on point in this appeal. Now, on page 298 of that decision, it says, quote, the spirit of constitutional principles does not support the subsequent use of the 1986 conviction for enhancement purposes without appropriate clarification and warning on the occasion of the 1986 plea bargain. Now, in that particular case, Smith, the appellee, was saying that 1986 plea may not have been adequate for enhancement purposes because the plea may not have been valid. This court rejected that argument, but still said that with her, the latter of her two DUI convictions, that the subsequent use would not have been appropriate because she had a reasonable expectation that that conviction would be a first offense for enhancement purposes. She made a deal where a second offense specifically dropped to a first offense. Now, the state of Nevada's position, this appeal, is to put the onus on Mr. Tosh to, in essence, sort out this very incomplete record we have in Faulkner County. The parties agree this record's unclear, but the state here goes to district court, presents a conviction from Faulkner County as unclear in so many respects, and the district court's putting the onus on Mr. Tosh.
Tell us what you think the standard should be. If we're going to write up a rule when we're dealing with out-of-state DUI convictions, you know, what evidence has to be submitted to the Nevada District Court in order to enhance based upon out-of-state convictions? What do you think the rule should be under our case law and your interpretation?
Well, when a case is charged as a second offense and eventually dealt as a first offense, I think we need to look at what the agreement was. And I think the prosecution should bring forth, since they are the movement, to bring forth what the deal was and present it to the district court judge to consider whether or not Mr. Tosh had the reasonable expectation that his conviction for first offense DUI in Faulkner County would be enhanceable as a second offense. Now, what the state does with respect to this 2008 conviction from Faulkner County says that the minutes don't specify whether or not this was to be treated as a first offense for enhancement purposes. And because of that lack of an indication, the state says treat it as a second offense.
As to the district attorney that was testified via phone, was there an objection to the testimony? Was the testimony given as, quote, an expert? What was offered, and was it objected to?
It was objected to from the onset. And I inferred from the record that the judge was overruling that objection. In fact, Ms. Hill, who's now the Elko County Public Defender, made it very clear she's objecting. And the objection was on the grounds that his testimony was irrelevant.
And it was not, because you can do phone testimony under the audiovisual rules and all, but so it was based on the substance of his testimony, then, correct? That was your objection?
Yes, Justice Stevens, that it was the ground for the objection that was overruled. Now, we look at State versus Smith. Was there a provision that said that Smith's latter of her two convictions would be treated as a first offense for enhancement purposes? And we look at a quote from State versus Smith, we see that that was not the case. Now, the quote from that case was that, quote, when Smith pleaded guilty to driving under the influence in 1986, the Reno City Attorney informed the district court judge that, quote, the defendant is going to be changing her plea to guilty to first-time DUI, unquote. The district court accepted her plea and, quote, based on the negotiations had between the attorneys, unquote, imposed a sentence commensurate with that indicated for first-time drunk driving offenders by NRS 484.3792 Section 1, where in that paragraph does it say that Smith is told this is a first offense for enhancement purposes? It's simply not in that paragraph. It's not anywhere in State v. Smith. State v. Smith looked at the reasonable expectations. Her reasonable expectations, Catherine Smith, that is the appellee, had a reasonable expectation to be treated as a first offense for enhancement purposes, even though it wasn't explicit. Is there a nuance here? There's a slight nuance between Smith's case and Mr. Tosh's case, because it's unclear whether Mr. Tosh's case was dealt down from a DUI second to a DUI first, whereas in Smith's case, that's quite explicit. That was the arrangement. But should there be a different results here between Smith and Tosh? The answer is no.
So your position is the burden should be on the state on this enhancement issue and showing why it should be applied for enhancement purposes, correct?
Yes, to show that spirit of constitutional principles are honored with respect to what happens in district court. Absolutely, yes. The onus should be on the state, not Mr. Tosh.
What's the burden? Beyond a reasonable doubt?
No, in fact, State v. Smith didn't articulate that, and none of the progeny has specifically articulated that whatsoever. So I'd submit that at the very least of preponderance, but I would submit.
So chances are it's preponderance and then like that.
That's what I would think, yes, Your Honor. But even if we assume...
Why do you think that? Why do you think it's a preponderance rather than clear and convincing or beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, just based on case law, there's not really any kind of specificity. It's not a criminal trial, so I don't think there's ever been any case law anywhere to state it's specifically beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, you think Scalia may rest in peace would say that it should be preponderance rather than beyond a reasonable doubt, that it's a jury function to determine all the facts as to whether there should be an enhancement? Would the jury decide if there's an enhancement or not, or would the judge be deciding that post the verdict?
My understanding would be the judge, insofar as I see no authority.
Well, it wouldn't be a jury trial anyway because it's a DUI. If it's no property or personal injury. So the judge would have to decide it, correct?
Yes, I would.
If it was third time DUI?
Yes.
A jury would decide it?
The jury would decide what specifically?
A third time DUI, I think. Isn't that a felony? Third time DUI?
Indeed.
And the jury trial, that would be a jury trial. So the burden would be different if it's second time DUI versus third time DUI?
No, Your Honor.
So you want to stick with preponderance? You want to go with me with beyond a reasonable doubt?
For in terms of enhanceability, I would submit, Your Honor, that it's not an element that the state...
I was trying to lead you to water. I guess you can't make somebody drink if they don't want to listen to them. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, we don't believe that Tosh's case is any different than Smith's in terms of the reasonable expectations. He would reasonably expect this to be a first offense for enhancement purposes. Now, the state puts reliance on Speer, and Speer did not overrule the Crisp, Perry, and Smith line of cases. Speer purported to interpret those three prior cases, and in State versus Smith, there was no provision specifically saying it's a first offense for enhancement purposes. Same with Perry, where the judge made the arrangement to drop the second offense to a first offense. In Perry, this court said it'd be inherently unfair to treat it as a second offense for enhancement purposes when the judge allowed this individual, pursuant to a plea bargain, to drop it down to a first offense. But the judge didn't say, you're getting this as a first offense for enhancement purposes. The judge did not say that whatsoever. Now, the state versus Crist, that's a case that's similar to this case, because in Crist, you had two prior convictions from Idaho. Both dealt as first offenses for enhancement purposes, and there was no discussion about how Idaho would deal with the case if Crist had committed another DUI in Idaho. Likewise, we don't need to analyze what would have happened if Tosh committed a third offense in Arkansas. But the facts in Speer are distinguishable. They're distinguishable because in Speer, he had a felony DUI from 1991, and he had first offense DUI from 1996. Now, the 1996 agreement said your first offense DUI is going to count as a second offense for enhancement purposes. We don't have that here in Tosh, so that doesn't apply. And Speer made this argument that was properly rejected, that only misdemeanor should be used for enhancement. That doesn't apply here because both of Mr. Tosh's misdemeanors here are as such. They were not felonies. They were both misdemeanors from Arkansas. So Mr. Tosh takes issue with Spear's interpretation of Chris Perry and Smith. Spear purports to interpret those cases. So right now what we have is a lack of clarity. We have Spear saying one thing and Chris Perry Smith saying the other. So to have consistency, what should happen? Well, we respectfully submit that Spear misinterpreted those prior cases. Chris Perry and Smith did not say that it must be in agreement that the first offense has to be a first offense for enhancement purposes. None of those three cases said that, but yet Spear interpreted those cases as such. So insofar as Spear is in contravention to Chris Perry and Smith, we'd ask that Spear be overruled in that respect. Because otherwise, we're still going to have a lack of clarity here, and there needs to be clarity, and Spear should be overruled in that regard. Even though Spear was decided correctly, the way that Spear was decided, we take issue with. And we respectfully ask that this court come to the conclusion that Tosh had a reasonable expectation that his first offense would be treated as a first offense for enhancement purposes, and that his felony conviction for DUI should be reversed accordingly, remanded with instructions that he be sentenced as a second offense DUI offender. Thank you for the opportunity.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Mills, and I represent the respondent, the state of Nevada in this case. As the appellant has just indicated, the appellant was convicted at a jury trial on March 18th, 2015 of a felony DUI. And prior to the sentencing hearing in this case, he challenged the prior that we've been talking about, the prior misdemeanor prior from July 10th, 2008 out of Faulkner County, Arkansas. He challenged the state's ability to use that prior to enhance the Nevada DUI to a felony. So the issue in this case is whether the state can rely upon that in enhancing the Nevada DUI to a felony. More specifically, it's an issue of whether there was a plea agreement struck in that prior case, which would preclude the state from doing that, which would limit the state's ability to enhance that prior. And it's the state's position that Spear versus State is the controlling case. If you look at the Smith line of cases starting in 1989, and Perry in 1990, Crist in 1992, those cases all kind of stood for the same proposition. And then Spear comes along in that proposition being that when a DUI second is pleaded down to a DUI first, it's for all purposes, including enhancement purposes. Now Spear took a different tack, and refined and clarified that rule that was enunciated in Smith, Crist, and Perry. And the rule that was enunciated by Spear was that basically any two prior convictions within the 7-year period, regardless of how they're designated, you know, two DUI firsts, for example, could be relied upon in enhancing a third to a felony if they're within the 7-year period. And more specifically, and this is the really important language from Spear that the state or the respondent believes is controlling in this case, quote, the rule recognized in that line of cases, you know, Smith, Crist, and Perry, that rule is not applicable where, as here, there is no plea agreement limiting the use of the prior conviction for enhancement purposes.
That's the concern we have. There was no plea agreement that was provided. There was a plea agreement. We just don't know what it is, or more specifically, the court in this case did not know what it is. All we have on the record, what's been put in evidence, that there was a first, or reduced down to a first. So the question for us is, how are we expected to find what is a reasonable expectation that looking at the progeny of Chris, Smith, and Spear, what is reasonable in this circumstance?
Well, I have a couple of responses to that. To that question. First of all, we do know a little something about the plea agreement that was struck in this case. On the joint appendix, page 436, which is the very conviction that we're all, that's at issue in this case, it says that the DUI second was amended to a DUI first in court due to lack of evidence after a request made to Sherwood. And the prosecutor who testified in this case kind of interpreted, well, what does Sherwood mean? Well, that's another district court. And based on his understanding of the and familiarity with the means of practice,
that is a whole other can of worms. And that is, you say a DA testified. Now, foundation for that DA testifying, an objection was raised, even though it was overruled. Did that particular district attorney have firsthand knowledge of this plea agreement, or have a copy of the plea agreement that they could at least, as an officer of the court, make representations?
He did not have a copy of the plea agreement. I'm not sure there would have been a written plea agreement. There, a lot of times, aren't in these misdemeanor cases. But he had a copy of this docket, and he had a familiarity with the way the DUI statutes and procedures work in the state of Arkansas. And that was the relevancy of his testimony. But you're absolutely right that in this case, we don't have any kind of written plea agreement in the record.
And the concern is this is not a civil proceeding. This is a criminal proceeding. So we look for a little more fact-based reasoning.
Mr. Mills, that's my concern, too. Notwithstanding the debate with Justice Kerry, preponderance versus beyond reasonable doubt, either way, the burden would be on the state. And if the state didn't come up with the plea bargain agreement, arguably, I'm not saying we're going to conclude that, but that's why we're here. If the burden's on the state, then the state would have to show that plea agreement as opposed to, because from what we've seen in this record, it looks like it was bargained down to a first-time offense, you know, like that on the plea in Faulkner County, from the record, with absent the plea agreement. So wouldn't that presumption out of due process go to the defendant? Then shouldn't we do that?
Well, let me address the burden question, because that seems to be an important issue in this case, and I agree with that. I gave a lot of thought to that issue. You know, how does the Davenport burden shift and all that kind of stuff factor into this analysis? And my response to the burden question is that, you asked a question earlier, you know, what should the rule be? What's the burden? Who has the burden? How does that work? We have a rule, and it should be applied. The rule is the Davenport rule. And what Davenport says is that if the state produces a record of a judgment of conviction which shows that the defendant was represented by counsel, then it is presumed that the conviction is constitutionally adequate, i.e. that the spirit of constitutional principles was respected. And the reason that this is applicable is because this links back up to Smith, where it invokes that exact phrase, and this line, it links back into this line of cases with the burden shift analysis. Smith talks about how, and I think the appellants responded to this, that Smith talks about, invokes that phrase, the spirit of constitutional principles does not support the subsequent use of the 1986 conviction for enhancement without appropriate clarification and warning. So that links it all back up into the appropriate standard. That makes it applicable. But what we're talking about falls under the umbrella of spirit of constitutional principles, which means that we apply the Davenport burden shift analysis. And applying that, the state produced the prior conviction, showing that he was represented by counsel, and then that shifts the burden over to the appellant to rebut this presumption of constitutionality. And this entire discussion that we're having about the priors and enhancements, that falls under that umbrella of spirit of constitutional principles. Smith says it does.
So you're now moving the burden on prior defense counsel to make an adequate record that of what the negotiations were? Is that what you're, in essence, doing?
I think that's what Davenport says.
Not necessarily that's what Davenport says. Davenport, you're correct in terms of representation by counsel. But we've gone to another layer of not just the underlying validity of being represented by counsel, but what was, again, the reasonable expectations of the party as to this plea agreement. Or was this a bait and switch, as they say in the trade? So, your office was straightforward and upright, but the question is what was done in the other court? In the other office, the out-of-state office.
Sorry, I didn't follow up. What was done in what other court?
Again, you are attempting to rely upon what was done in the out-of-state court as to the validity of this reduction down to a first. We don't have anything of from my standpoint, adequate credibility to tell us that it was negotiated with the knowledge that it could be used for enhancement purposes, or in the other, could not be used for enhancement purposes. So that's kind of a dilemma.
And the record is, I guess, silent on that issue. But applying Davenport, like, again, because it, Smith brings it back up into Davenport and the Davenport burden shift analysis, it's, the analysis would go like this. Does the burden meet its burden of production on the prior? And it did. The court found that it did.
But does it answer the operative question that's before us? That is, what was the negotiation?
And then that would be, because it's not on the conviction itself, that the burden would shift to the defendant to show that. And the easy way for him to show that and meet that burden.
Does the defendant have to show it, or does he merely have to say that that was not his reasonable expectation?
Well, you know, he could have done that. You look at, I think it was Perry, one of these cases, the defendant, or the appellant in that case, or defendant, took the stand and testified that at the time of that entry of plea, it was my expectation that this could not be used for enhancement. So that's how they... Anyway, there were ways that the appellant could have potentially met that burden. He could have testified that he didn't have a reasonable explanation. But the point is that under Davenport, the burden shifted to the appellant, and the appellant presented no evidence to overcome the presumption of constitutionality. And so applying that standard... This is a constitutionally valid prior upon
which... So I guess the question then, assuming we agreed with you, is what does the defendant have to show to rebut the presumption then? Is it testimony? Is it the plea bargain agreement? If we turn back the clock and you're back in Elko County District Court here, what's Mr. Tosh have to do at that stage then, in your opinion?
Any of the above.
Pardon me?
Any of the above. He could testify about what happened and what his reasonable expectation was. He could track down the court proceedings or any other evidence. He called the defense attorney from that case. Lots of options.
Was Mr. Kutosh given an opportunity to testify at this hearing?
Yes, he was.
And he chose not to?
He chose not to.
Okay.
And the only thing that was introduced by the state, corporately, was this copy of the conviction from out of state that says DUI first.
That's correct. And the testimony from the prosecutor to provide a little context.
Well, that's an issue within an issue.
And so that's, and as far as the burden goes, there was a discussion about the burden, should it be beyond a reasonable doubt or preponderance of the evidence. That question also is answered by this court's jurisprudence. If you look at the Koenig, Dressler, Davenport, Pepitas line of cases, it talks about what the burden is. When the burden shifts, what's the burden? It's preponderance of the evidence. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. The beyond a reasonable doubt standard applies in the case in chief as far as proving elements, but as far as other stuff like this or putting on affirmative defenses, the burden shifts to the defendant in those situations, and when it shifts, it's a preponderance of the evidence standard of proof.
Do I understand correctly, because Justice Gibbons asked the questions before, based on Justice Cherry's questions, was Mr. Tosh convicted for a trial?
Yes, he was. There was a jury trial in this case, and he was convicted of a felony DUI. That's correct.
Which then takes us back to Justice Cherry's questions of this being an enhancement. Should the enhancement have gone to the jury based upon, I'll use the term, lack of specificity of the evidence provided as to the prior plea agreement?
Like in a second proceeding? Or in the second trial?
Because there's Supreme Court law on certain enhancements which judges can do and other enhancements judges can't do that should be enhanced based upon a jury making findings.
In other words, the defendant could have asked for a lesser included offense of second time DUI rather than third time DUI.
And then had the jury decide that in the context of the jury trial itself?
Right. That's why I asked the question about Scalia with the issue about especially in federal court, with certain enhancements have to be decided by the jury rather than by the judge.
And we realize this issue hasn't even been raised in the appeal, so we're putting you both on the spot.
It is a constitutional issue.
It is. So, I mean, I think it's a good question, though, that we're going to have to tackle it sooner or later.
I'm unaware of any jurisprudence that would allow for that. In fact, just out of fairness to defendants, we typically go to great pains and great lengths to prevent them from knowing that there are, in fact, prior DUI convictions. We take that information away from the jury so it doesn't prejudice the defendant. But I'm not unaware of any case that would say that it's within the jury's province to decide an enhancement issue. I don't think it works that way with domestic violence, third offenses.
It works with deadly weapons.
What was that?
It works with a deadly weapon.
With deadly weapon enhancements?
Yeah, possession.
Yeah, that's distinguishable because it's not necessarily a prior conviction on something. But
it's an enhancement. That's where we're talking about enhancements.
Yeah. Oh, an enhancement, yeah. So, but I'm unaware of any case that would allow for the jury, for holding that would be within the province of the jury to decide that issue beyond a reasonable doubt, the constitutionality of the priors and that kind of thing. Dressler, Coney, none of those cases talk about that as being an issue for the jury.
Can I ask you this, Mr. Mills? We're kind of giving you guys a hard time because we're kind of shooting all over the place trying to get to a rule on this situation here, and that's why I appreciate you both being here. Did Judge Porter at this hearing, when you presented this evidence, this exhibit you referred to and all, did she say to Mr. Tosh, and Mr. Tosh, you can testify if you want regarding this enhancement issue, or how did the procedure actually happen in court when this was the enhancement part of this case when it was presented? Did he know he had an opportunity to testify to rebut that or not? Was that kind of skipped over?
Well, this was in the context of the sentencing proceeding, and every time in a sentencing proceeding, the defendant is advised that they have an opportunity to make a statement. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that was specifically addressed in the context of arguing this motion, but he was represented by counsel, mm-hmm. who presumably would have, if there were relevant evidence that her client could have provided, she could have just had that discussion with him and put that evidence on in the context of that.
And I understand, that's probably how it normally happens, but I guess we're kind of the Monday morning quarterbacks here at this stage, here looking at this to try and get a fair rule to both sides, and like that.
Anything further?
Just to reiterate that in the respondent's view, it's a simple analysis. There is an analysis, and it's already in place, and it's in Davenport. And again, you look at Smith, and that links up the very issue we're talking about. It shows that we're within the Davenport line of cases because we're talking about the spirit of constitutional principles, and then boom, that links us into Davenport, and the analysis is already there in writing. And that's the analysis the state would ask this court to adopt and affirm the court's decision below. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you to both of you for your arguments in this matter and the briefs in this matter. And thanks for putting up with this last argument on Friday. We had all week of Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of arguments. So thank you both, especially for coming from Elko. Justice Gibbons and I had a real, have gone to Elko to present cases at the high school there, and we were well received. And we thank the community of Elko for the Public Defender's Office and for the DA's Office.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And this case will stand submitted.